Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 229, Gross National Happiness.
Nirvana, freedom from suffering, which is the Buddha's great discovery and the foundation of Buddhism, as well that happiness is, or bliss, that bliss is, that freedom from suffering, as well, I believe, as the subliminal inspiration of the concept of gross national happiness. After all, what other great human teacher claimed that human life, when enlightened, can be utterly free of suffering? In other words, even in the religious traditions, the theistic traditions, they never say, this is a veil of suffering, you know, the veil of misery, and we, you know, you have to suffer through it, the sinner, you know, and then God will save you later, and after death you might be okay if you belong to the right tradition and if you have the right faith. But that human beings could be free of suffering is not, nobody says that, other than the Buddha, really, basically, ultimately free of suffering. Freud, he said, I can help you with your neurotic suffering. And then when you're free of that neurotic suffering, you can get back to regular suffering and healthy, have a healthy suffering. And that was Freud's idea. Now, just to run through the noble truths to back up that, what I'm saying, of the four noble truths, the first is the noble truth of suffering, which actually is part of what eventually Buddha describes as conventional or illusory reality. Not a complete illusion, but an illusory reality. The cause of suffering, his analysis of that, namely egotistical ignorance and delusion, is also conventional reality. Nirvana, freedom from suffering and bliss, is the actual reality. You know, ultimate reality means the actual reality, the real reality, let's say. So that's that third noble truth is the one that he really discovered to be the nature of reality. Therefore, that is why I say that the achievement of bliss or happiness is the foundation of his movement, of the Buddhist movement. Then the Eightfold Path, which is the fourth noble truth, is also conventional reality, although it is the therapy for the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, to remove suffering. And the Buddha's great discovery, therefore, is number three. It doesn't take a Buddha to discover suffering. All you have to do is like break your leg or stub your toe or have, you know, somebody die or whatever. Suffering is abundant. Abundantly discoverable, but freedom from suffering is hard to find, and hard to anyone claim that they really found it. In a way, is preposterous to the ordinary worldly mind. They sort of, you know, they think, well, Buddhism is a religion. It's sort of a nice thing. He had people believe, but people just don't believe that it's possible, really. So therefore, they basically are not very inspired. Even Buddhists are not really inspired to try to attain nirvana. They sort of think that, well, some people attain nirvana in Buddha's time. Buddha, I guess, attained nirvana. Maybe I can in a future life. But I wouldn't expect to do so any particular time. And therefore, I have to just be resigned to suffering. That's most Buddhists feel that way as well. Freedom from suffering, of course, is bliss and happiness. And millions have attained it over the 2,500 years or 2,600 years of Buddhism. Guru Rinpoche, the Shabdrung, they all attained it. And Bhutan's culture is based on it, and therefore gross national happiness. Now here I thought I would just compare the branches of the Eightfold Path. The first one, of course, is what people often call right view. I don't like right because it's sort of like as if it follows a rule or follows somebody's order. But the branches of the Eightfold Path, I think Samyak is, or Yandak, is better translated as realistic. So I translate as realistic worldview. And that the realistic worldview that the Buddha taught was the worldview of relativity, causality, you know, Tendel, and of course, the knowledge of which leads to nirvana. So that's his realistic worldview. So in other words, you don't have to make a huge like leap of faith or to adopt a realistic worldview. It doesn't mean adopting anything unreasonable or blind faith thing. It means simply being accepting of causality completely, accepting of relativity, accepting of being connected to everything in the world to a full degree, which we do not, nor the unenlightened person does not do. The unenlightened person accepts a certain level of causality, but they think that inside themselves there's a separated self, an absolute self that somehow is immune to that causality. And therefore they tend not to have a realistic worldview. Now, does the outer modern world, with all its science and all its supposed knowledge and its universities and its philosophers, does it have realistic worldview by that definition? No, it does not. The we, or they, have either an absolutist theism or dominant is a nihilistic materialism. And there is temporary causality. Now, as for the first, there is a temporary causality in the miserable sinner's world of the absolutist theist. And then God, who is an absolute that acts relatively, somehow unrealistically, that an absolute can act relatively, lifts the soul out of the faithful believer. So there is not a full acceptance of causality, is my point. And therefore, from the point of view of realistic worldview, it's unrealistic. And they themselves say it's a blind faith issue. There's no, you know, don't think you can reason yourself to the existence of this absolute who will save you, save your absolute soul, no matter what you've done, as long as you have the right belief. On the other side, we have the modern, so-called modern people whose theory is of reality, which we all somewhat imprisoned by, is that really, reality is really nothing. Nothingness is the foundation of reality. And there is no soul and no mind, only a brain, no consciousness that is really a thing, a continuum of its own. No, therefore, no very importantly, no future and no past life. And that life is accidental, it's a random, it's a meaningless, it's a purposeless, and so forth. And that is the view of the, that is the worldview of scientific materialism, very forcefully argued. It has its profits and so on. And it's not realistic from Buddha's point of view. To expect, for anyone to expect that you can become nothing is an unrealistic worldview from the Buddha's point of view. Second, based on the branch two is realistic motivation about the way of living, how to live. Based on realistic worldview of evolutionary causality, one makes life purposeful and meaningful by using the precious human intelligence and compassion to evolve in a positive direction in this life and the future up to perfect Buddhahood or enlightenment. So that would naturally be a worldview when you fully accept that you are a causal being, therefore you are an evolutionary being, and your evolution is determined by what you do, which includes not only what you physically do, but what you verbally do and what you mentally do. Then you become forced by that realistic worldview to take up a motivation of acting in a positive way and thinking in a positive way and speaking in a positive way, because you have accepted the responsibility for shaping your own future existence. You don't think that somehow it'll just be nothing at some point, no matter how you just slough through it, and you don't think that someone else can save you by coming from some detached absolute, some absolutely other absolute, no matter what you do, just because you have an open mind of belief, and especially unreasonable belief, which tends to be weak, actually. Blind faith-based belief tends to be weak. Branches 3, 4, and 5 are the ethical branches, and which are, you know, realistic speech, realistic evolutionary action, and realistic livelihood. And these ethical branches are there with the lip service in the modern world, but no real reason to observe them except for show. However, in the Buddhist biological theory, and this is something maybe I innovate in saying, but I think it's arguably defendable, karma is not a mystical, religious sort of blind faith, oh gee, karma did something. It's not fate. Karmic theory is a theory of causality, and it's an evolutionary theory of causality, and it is a biological theory of causality. It is the Buddha's way of accounting for the differences of our life, like why are we the way we are, each individual, why are we human and not an animal, why are we not this and that, or we could become that if we behave that way. And it has to do with we are caught in the mind is involved in evolution, in other words. It's very close to Darwinian theory, actually, in the sense that it shows the connection of the human and the animal and then various other life forms. But the difference, of course, with the neo-Darwinian scientific materialist theory is that the mind is part of evolution. And the human mind evolves. And the human mind, in a way, controls the evolution. Not the human mind, the animal mind, anybody's mind. And so if you added a mind as hopping from gene carrier to gene carrier, in addition to the genes hopping along, if you added a mind that was hopping and was causally efficacious, then that would be the karma theory, biological theory. And I think when the materialist science realizes that it has been trapped in a dogma, in a blind faith dogma of materialism, and they bring a mind back into consciousness, back into a field of scientific study, they will find karma as one possible theory. Of course, it's not the absolute truth. No Buddhist theory about relative reality is the absolute truth, only relative truth. And that, which is another important point in Buddhist hermeneutics. So anyway, in the biological theory of karmic evolution, the branches of the tenfold branches of skillful or unskillful evolutionary action, the Gewe Lam or Migewe Lam Chu, Gewe Lam Chu or Migewe Lam Chu, Gewak translating Sanskrit Kushala, which means skill actually rather than virtue, i.e. action that shapes one's future, there is a scientific reason to be ethical, and one who understands this can easily internalize ethical code as having the element of enlightened self-interest. That is, you behave well, you speak well, you think well in order to have a better future, at least for yourself, as well as, if you can take the next step, to be of benefit to others. And that is an evolutionary effort that underlies those branches of ethics in the Eightfold Path. The sixth one, the creative evolutionary effort, or, you know, avidya, zendru, the key here is to avoid despair, cynicism, and depression. And it's not merely the antidote to laziness, although that's the traditional way it's explained. But the attitude is that what really prevents people from exerting effort in positive evolution, in positively turning their life toward a very positive direction, body, speech, and mind, is the attitude, and turning the world in such a positive direction, is the attitude that it doesn't matter ultimately. So why bother? And it won't work. You know, the biggest cause, for example, I personally feel very strongly that the biggest cause of the modern outer worlds not stopping carbon emissions, which they know very well, except for a few, you know, the polluters, of course, hire some fake scientists to pretend that it's just a theory, and there's no real evidence that Greenland is melting, the Himalayas are melting, the polar ice caps are melting. You know, that's just fake. Everybody really knows that we're melting the ice caps, and we're looking to major destruction on the planet very soon. I think, what is it they say, we're 20 years past the worst case analysis given 5 years ago or something like that. People have such theories, such calculations, you know. The IPCC, the International ICCP Climate Change Committee or whatever it is. So the biggest cause of the modern so-called outer, enlightened, developed outer world, not outer from Bhutan, I'm saying, not stopping carbon emissions and not shifting from militarism to arts of peaceful creativity, is the idea that it won't help, that nothing works, that life is impossible, and the problem is just solved for the individual by dying and becoming nothing and having an endless sleep, never mind whether things get flooded and Bangladesh goes underwater and whatever happens doesn't matter, because anybody who dies, once they die, then they're gone and it didn't have any meaning in their life anyway. And that is the depressing thought of modern materialism, and it is why people are reckless in relation to the planet that we live on, the climate. It's that cynical view that why should I do anything because it really won't help. It's like in America today, I think almost 40, sometimes 50% of the people don't vote in elections because they think all the politicians are no good. There's no real difference between them. So why should I bother to cast, even do that little bit of effort, make that little bit of effort to move toward the positive? So the cynicism, you know, is really deadly. Now, finally, branches 6 and 7, which are mindfulness and smriti, you know, and samadhi, mindfulness and concentration, based on the realistic worldview, commitment, and ethical stability, the individual realizes the necessity of bringing the mind under control. Because when you realize that what you think affects your future evolution, not only what you physically do or verbally do, but even what you think, then you really have to, you can't just settle for having an unconscious filled with negative impulses and just get your psychiatrist to help you sort of channel them or vent them in some way where you don't act on them. But rather, you have to go in and clean them out. You have to go down into your unconscious. You can't be driven into future life by an out-of-control unconscious. Now, if you compare modern life to a realistic life, modern life involves addiction to television, to internal impulses coming out of absolute self, a sense of absolute self. You know, when someone feels, I have to be angry, or I have to have that object, or I have to shop for this, or I have to say that to them, or I have to press this button or do that. They feel, when they hear themselves think that internally, they have to do it. They're victims of their mind rather than their mind is their own tool. They are the tool of their mind. And so, in modern life, people are like that. And through frustration, therefore, says dissatisfaction, anxiety, and stress. And we all know it. And those who have the mass of 1 in 7 Bhutanese today who have moved here into the city, leaving the villages, supposedly the backward life of the villages, come to the modern stress life. They're already involved, and they're all understanding, I think, the youth I'm talking, of course, especially frustration, dissatisfaction, anxiety, and stress. And since it is taught that you don't have a mind by modern science, they assure you from MIT, Harvard, any place, that you don't really have a mind. You just have a brain. You're just running around carrying this brain. The brain is making you like a robot, run around and carry it. You don't have a mind, and therefore you can't possibly control yourself, and therefore you need Prozac when you're stressed out, and you need this drug when you want to sleep, and you need another drug when you want to wake up, and it's just more material. You need to depend on them to control the material process that you are, helpless as you are. You know? I always laugh. In our core curriculum in our Western universities, I was at a college called Amherst College that thinks it's a very, very elite college and has a very special core curriculum. And one of the key courses that people take is one called Darwin, Marx, and Freud. And supposedly, if you really get Darwin, Marx, and Freud, then you're really a modern person and you're really hip, you know. Then you can go out and, like, go to Wall Street and make a fortune. And in coming out of an elite college. But actually, if you look at the philosophies of Darwin, Marx, and Freud, Darwin would have you be the helpless victim of your genes. Marx would have you be the helpless victim of your position in society. And Freud would have you be the helpless victim of your unconscious. And therefore, bottom line, helpless. Therefore, join Goldman Sachs and make some money. Make some money, and never mind what effect it has on people. Because you just live, eat, drink, and be merry, and then die, and that'll be fine. And we'll take care of you also with better and better mind-altering drugs, right? So that's the modern life. But in the life that tries to live according to the Eightfold Path, that is to say, according to the refined national happiness or individual happiness, mindfulness, smriti, means really, the word means memory. And it means instead of ruminating in your mind as you're going around remembering things, and removing yourself from what you're actually doing because you're lost in your memories, or being lost in your imagination and fantasies of future things that will happen to you, you bring your mind into the present, and you see what your mind is doing, and you start to gain control of your mind. And like I always like to say, if you develop a little mindfulness practice, basically even just breath counting and bringing your mind back to concentrate, even the slightest bit helps enormously, and it's like you realize that you can control your mind. You don't just have to follow every thought impulse to wherever it takes you. You learn to choose between the different thoughts in your mind. When a thought arises in your mind like, I've got to be furious because of this and that, and I'm going to lose my temper, and I'm going to destroy this or do that, then you can have another side of the mind can say, why is that? Who are you telling me to do that? You can talk back to yourself, and you can learn to control yourself. Like a person who has a clicker for their television. They don't have to watch that one channel without muting the commercials or switching the channel when some idiot is on the tube. If you had only a television set that only had one channel and you had to watch it all the time, That would be the state of a non-mindfulness person, unmindful person. Finally, samadhi, concentration, is needed to bring reasonable understanding of the self and life, which is developed by learning, by realistic worldview, and then meditation can join that realistic worldview. It's actually dangerous without the realistic worldview, because that kind of concentration will only heighten the unrealistic worldview, which is why so many people who meditated for a long time jump up as gurus and behave egotistically. And people are so surprised because they meditated a lot. But that's because they were not combining that meditation with learning about the nature of the self and of reality. But once you do get some learning about that, then meditation is essential to drive that understanding deeper into your unconscious and making it truly transformative of your life. Okay, that's part one. Now, next part. Now, how the GNH principle empowers the new development of economy. So here, the question arises, how does real happiness, I'm sorry for my typos, I did this quickly, how does real happiness attract real wealth? And here, first, Bhutan has emerged worldwide as a global beacon of sustainable lifestyle, which, you know, we hope will not be disappearing under economic pressures. Foremost of all, and therefore it's inspiring to people all over the world, and it attracts people to come here, and the tourist income is not inconsequential, in fact. And that's one of the reasons. Foremost of all, to the Bhutanese themselves, therefore, as the first pillar of one kind of their important economic inputs, is the Bhutanese have the challenge to maintain their own real happiness. If they lose their happiness by being swept up in the demented pursuit of growth and development and industrial wealth, then they might very well, they will lose their happiness, because the countries that are like that do have a loss of happiness. Bhutan, the miserable person cannot make others happy. Therefore, Bhutan must not become over-dependent on outside economic forces, because it will only result in its loss of its resources, and then the individuals will lose their happiness. And then think, why do we love Bhutan? You know, we, the world, people of the world, and people in Bhutan too. Well, Bhutan has not only resources, but also values lost already by outsiders. The wealth of natural resources is extraordinary. The soil is not yet totally polluted by industrial chemicals, as our American soil is. Cancer is a big thing in America. And doctors are quickly trying to look for this virus and that virus. But actually, the cancer lives in the soil of America. Since the World War, they've been throwing chemical upon chemical into the soil, and pesticides, and also growth chemicals, and these things, and injecting the meat of the animals that they slaughter in a very, very unhumane manner, with all kinds of other chemicals to make money. And this goes into the people who eat it, and therefore cancer is in the very lifestyle, actually. It's not just something coming from outer space, some virus that came because they have longer lifespans because of whatever reason, because of public health things. But it's public health is not looking, therefore, at what the food industry is doing to the bodies of the American people. China is supposed to be a miracle, oh, wonder of wonders, a few hundred million people in a so-called middle class. I think really basically the money concentrated mainly in the elite, as it is in America, communist or not. And yet the soil there is also completely polluted. You know, the four elements, you know, soil, water, fire, and wind, the air. And the soil is polluted, the water is polluted, the temperature is excessive, and it's pouring carbon into raising the temperature of the planet, and melting actually the glaciers at the root of the river systems that flow into China as well as here in Bhutan and India. And the air is unbreathable in most of the places. And so what kind of wealth do they have? Well, they have enough wealth to get out of there, actually. And I think the elite have a lot of bank accounts in China, in Canada and in US and in the British Virgin Islands and in London and everywhere. Because they can see it's not livable the way it is. They're talking about trying to fix it, and I believe actually they will. I don't want to preach doomsday. I actually think they will change and do it. But the point is that the materialist people with their distorted notion of development, pointing to it as a miracle at the moment, is not really realistic. Lots of money for the elite, but still mass poverty still exists there, and environment is ruined totally. A lot of internal violence, tension, and aggression, in a society basically very low on the happiness index. In the contemporary science of happiness, which has very much been stimulated by Bhutan, actually, you know that Joseph Stiglitz and Amartya Sen did a big study, you all know about it, for Sarkozy when he was president of France. And then there are sociologists in England and in America who are studying happiness. And in the study of happiness, China and America are down, way down in the list. China worse, much worse than America, but still way down. And, you know, the Norwegians, the Scandinavians, they're cheerful. And the Dutch, and I'm not sure where Bhutan hits, but probably still pretty good. But I forget where they list it from their studies. You know? Okay, so these values in Bhutan should generate a special economy, leveraging their traditional wisdom, but in a modern way. Take the spiritual industry. That is an industry, actually. You know, there's this whole thing about, you know, Dharma is for free and don't charge for it. But on the other hand, the monks come, even in ancient time, and they demand a free lunch. They come out with that begging bowl and they demand lunch. They want to be supported by the society. And actually, traditionally, the society has been happy to support them because they have added to the happiness value in India first and then all over Asia. They never conquered anybody to make them Buddhist. They had no such crusade. When there are more people becoming mindful, becoming less violent, dropping out, and when there's the place to escape from an oppressive family situation, etc., a place to seek education when you had no education in an agricultural, non-literacy promoting society, then they will go there. And the Buddhist monasteries and the monastic universities have thrived, therefore, as an industry. And here, if Bhutan's already, I think, Bhutan example would be Gandhi Tukul, who has many disciples abroad, Dzongzhar Khyentse Rinpoche, many, many disciples abroad. They don't bring them enough to Bhutan, perhaps because they haven't yet developed the kind of facility where they can keep them for a long period of time. I think only the people maybe who think they're ready for some 3-year long retreat or something really drastic. But how about a 1-week retreat, a weekend retreat, a 3-week retreat, a 1-month retreat? This would be economically a high value-added piece of industry, in fact. They would be, you know, it would be better than just driving up and down the roads. It could command a better market, and it would be very beneficial to many people. And which Bhutanese, either lama or layperson, knows how to deliver that in large quantity? Who is being trained to do that? Dzongzhar Khyentse can go outside and deliver it, and so can Gandhi Tukul and so forth, but very few. But there's no reason why it should be so very few. It's very possible that many others could learn to do that. And that would be a very important economic benefit to Bhutan. In a way, the spiritual side of Bhutan would have like a big begging bowl and get a lot of grants with no interest and no debt and no need for loans. And then, of course, it's a little tricky with the spiritual because the Dharma is free, you know, ultimately. It's available for everyone, should be. And the industry part only in making that availability easily accessible and responsibly delivered, actually. I like to say, you know, religion, I like to say that religions in general are service industries. They are, and their religions lose their religious and spiritual quality, and why a lot of people in the world today like to say, I'm not religious, but I am spiritual. It's very common in any of the developed, in the sort of educated societies. And why they say that, because religions forget that they're there to serve their adherents. You know, religious people do. They get involved in the institution, and they think they own their adherents, and therefore they want to get bigger market share, and they compete with each other, and they fight with each other, and they create conflict, and they're intolerant of each other. But those are not really doing what the founders of the religions intended. The founders of religions intended to serve people, and any religion that has less is just serve them. In fact, I argue that Buddhism is less religion and more educational institution, and only adopted as a religion by people who, in a way, cannot access the educational service that is mainly what Buddhism is, which I'll come to later in the talk. Then the health industry. Bhutanese medicine, like Tibetan medicine, Ayurveda, and Chinese medicine, true traditional Chinese, not only acupuncture, but herbal and acupuncture, are actually becoming quite in vogue in the West, worldwide, and they are connecting with herbalist traditions in the industrial societies. And then industrial medicine is beginning to develop some of its sort of more innovative and creative wielders of industrial medicine are beginning to look at a model of what they call integrative medicine, where there is knowledge about nutrition, about lifestyle, about mental things as connected to the physical body and so on. And there is a movement in that direction. The mainstream, of course, still of industrial medicine is commercial, and it is, you know, they were going to conquer everything with the genome project, and then they would, since you're just a gene carrier, they would fix you up. So they would control everything about your life by understanding the gene. And of course, they found out that that was simplistic, and it's much more complicated. And then the psychiatrists are mad, the principled ones that I know, because they can only use the talking cure, the more spiritual side of psychiatry, with wealthy people, because the insurance companies will not pay for it, and they want them to give them some drug right away, anybody else. And they give these deadly drugs that have, you know, serotonin, and they mess with the brain in ways that they do not understand. And they still trumpet it, though, as triumphal, and they're about to understand it, like they always say, but they actually are causing a big mess to a lot of people. And so, therefore, the Bhutanese Tibetan medicine tradition, with its natural botany based on thousands of years of experimental, trial and error and analysis. It's not just holistic; it's analysis of plants and plant powers, knowledge of nutrition, very thorough knowledge of the relation of ethical lifestyle and or unethical lifestyle and health, and the meditative side of it from the medicine Buddha. You know, Sanjay Menla, is something of immense value. And Bhutan is perfectly positioned to develop an integrative using that and by training people in that in a modern way to attract high value added health tourism like Thailand has. Thailand has it for industrial medicine. You go get surgery, dentistry. I do actually, and get away from the high prices in the Western countries and have excellent quality industrial medical service. But no country has emerged as the champion of the integrative medical thing. China is moving in that direction quite a bit with the popularity of acupuncture and a little bit less knowledge of herbal medicine. But they because of the communist thing, they don't have the spiritual side that the medicine Buddha thing has. So therefore, products derived from these two major industries that could be Bhutan's happiness-based industries, value-adding industries. You have herbal medicines, which could be distributed worldwide in a very properly marketed, not only just raw cordyceps as a raw material, but compounded in various ways to amplify and to balance its benefit. Not just letting someone come in and loot your cordyceps by bribing farmers across the border, but using it yourself and value-adding it here with knowledge of traditional physicians and traditional pharmacologists to make that major production out of it and do it in a sustainable way by not over-harvesting and so forth. Bhutan is well-positioned to do that, and many other herbs that are really valuable. There's a Swiss company that is very successful, the Padma company, that uses Tibetan formulas, would be very happy, I'm sure, to work with such an industry here in Bhutan in helping the marketing in the West, you know, for example, worldwide. In Japan, it's huge. Actually, Tibetan herbal medicine is hugely profitable both in India and China, even though the one in India is validly and authentically done. The one in China is done in a big rush, unsustainably, but the mystique of the pure Tibet, the pure snowland, as they call it, is so huge in the polluted Shanghai and polluted Beijing that it's a very, very successful industry, and even without the spiritual element at all. And even though some of it is not well compounded, in fact, they just grind up some yak bones, for example, and give it to you for back pain. There's one big famous with making fortune doing that, even which is not good. It's not sustainable because it's not really well done. But with a good product, and with the good marketing, it would be a really big industry. And then another one is this pure, you have, I know, this nice Bhutanese spring water, which is, it's dew fresh. That's good. But if we gave that to some marketing, advertising person, and you should be having Bhutanese young trained in advertising, it might not be, it has little press from the Himalayan kingdom of Bhutan. But to be, you know, they'd have in the West and worldwide, they have this Fiji water. And Fiji has no reputation of being a magical, mystical happiness island. I don't think so. But everybody has Fiji water everywhere because they have some aquifers that somebody bought. And the Fijians don't necessarily profit that much from it. But the Bhutanese can profit themselves from it very, very well if they learn to, and they can get out and compete with Fiji, Pellegrino, Evian, etc. Coming from, Evian comes from a place in France where, you know, it's not that clean. The soil is not that clean. Pellegrino is pretty good from some mountain. You know, Pellegrino means pilgrim, so it has a little spiritual thing. And the Italians, you know, it's Italian, so it has the mystique of Italy, you know. But you guys have an even better mystique. Then organic agricultural products, and here I want to mention the wonderful project, again by Dzongsar Khyentse Rinpoche, the Samdrup Dzongkhar project, or Gongkhar project, in near somewhere near Tashigang in the far southeast, where they're teaching village by village organic gardening, waste, zero waste management, appropriate technology, and youth engagement. I think that's quite marvelous. And that would be required to have Bhutan gain the international reputation that its marmalade or its apple jam or its apple juice is going to have some sort of special quality about it that will not be matched by those that come from polluted, you know, industrial agricultural processes. And that will then give you value adding to your agricultural production and not just become a resource provider, as happens, unfortunately, to countries that buy into the model of industrial development. So next slide. Every Bhutanese youth should have instruction in the Buddhist sciences of mind. Entrepreneurs should develop medicine Buddha spa resorts, for which they need to train many young people in the arts of healing, theory of Ayurveda, the Guzhi medicine, Menla medicine, massage therapy. Some of them will not all be doctors. Some of them will be massage therapists, sports therapy. You know, then people can come and train for sports therapy and, whatever different sports there are. They can do altitude training here, like people go to Colorado to train in altitude. Nutrition. You know, industrial medicine in medical school, Columbia Medical School, they get like one class hour of nutritional training in four years of medical school. They don't know whether you should eat spinach or you know, datsi, emadatsi. They wouldn't know whether you should eat emadatsi or like chocolate pudding. It makes no difference to them. They think that's just all nothing compared to the powerful industrial medicines. So they don't realize that medicine, which we know, and all of you Bhutanese know that, the first line of medicine or poison is your diet. Right? And you all eat this great diet, a lot of emadatsi, to help you digest the yak meat, and which are for healthy yaks, I hope, not injected with anything. So yoga instruction even, you know. So that's what your entrepreneurs should be doing here. Rather than trying to build factories and trying to compete with Calcutta and Ranjitpur, whatever it is, Rangapur, those places, and get polluted like them. That would not really be the direction. But this kind of industry will be really beneficial to Bhutan, and the people delivering this will be happy, because people who do deliver this kind of service that improves people's happiness and health are happy in delivering it. So also the botany of medicinal herbs, how to cultivate, harvest, find them in nature, harvest sustainably for products. The wonderful thing about this kind of industry is that young Bhutanese would have to learn the values of their own culture in order to deliver them for a sustainable and yet profitable livelihood to the world as it comes here, you know, and to themselves and to the world as it comes here. So then one last thing, and my friend Drukpa Khunle, the community, which I think is where he's working on, which is so important, and the country has to be wired in the most modern way so that young people in villages can access global information and network and feel connected to the world without leaving their village. So there's more motivation to find, to develop and find a modern, natural, balanced life without leaving the parents bereft in the villages with a labor shortage and come to an unemployment situation in an overcrowded urban center where there is no industrial base to support them, nor will there likely be. Without it becoming something done by outside people, all the money coming from outside and all the money going back outside. So why submit yourself to that? Don't bother. I mean, this will control excess urbanization, although for the moment urbanization perhaps is inevitable, and therefore it should be turned into the education center. and all the any empty houses that might be there due to an overheated real estate market, possibly unrealistically overheated real estate market, every empty house should be turned into a school, yoga school, a massage school, a health center, whatever kind of school it may be. Or it could be an internet or, you know, design center, you know. It could be from the supermodern, the postmodern, and the traditional in combination, not the modern, which is just self-destructive. Also, and my colleague Dirkwa Kundlein knows this very well, people do need to have fun. And I think one of the reasons a lot of the young like to come to Thimphu is there's more fun here. So, but in a way, the fun that is when you're deracinated from your parents, a little bit might be good to be away from your parents, to some extent, might be fun. But if you're completely away from them and you're living in such a totally different lifestyle that the village comes to seem like a strange place to you, and your place seems strange to the people in the village, that gulf being too much is no good. So there's a rediscovery of the fun of family life, the interrelations within the village and within the craft communities. Someone told me that the other day that the weaving communities used to weave in the open with everyone weaving together and with singing and with a sort of a community life. And now somehow, because of some sort of financial economic pressure on it, they weave it separately and in isolation, and it changes their attitude and their feeling. Are you with me? Okay. Yeah. So now to move to this. This is where I just wanted to run through this, because I've been mentioning this in previous talks again and again as something from the Buddhist side in a different way to interface with the college system here and the high school system. But I never tried to give an example, and I just sort of mentioned it, and I think maybe nobody knew what I was talking about. And so it seems to, you know, the lamas don't change the way they teach Dharma, they just teach the lamas. They don't necessarily think they can teach the lay people. They come for ceremonies, but they can't actually teach them, and they're not trained to do so, which they should be, and which they will be whenever this is understood. It is counterproductive. Now, to come to the Buddhist sciences, I'm coming to that. It is counterproductive, of course, to compare religions unfavorably with each other, since they are matters of faith, not reason. And faith is defined usually as blind faith, not reasonable faith. And so criticizing each other only leads to conflict. When you believe something without a reason, but just because of a tradition or because of an impulse or an intuition, and since you don't have reasons, you can't argue with someone else with reasons, and therefore it turns quickly into conflict. So religion shouldn't be compared like that. So I follow His Holiness the Dalai Lama in saying that Buddhism is best for him, but he doesn't want to say it's best for any other person. But in science, it's a different matter. There is a right and wrong in scientific measurement and in scientific theory. And it's part of the enterprise to compare Einstein and Newton and current practitioners of physics, biology, psychology, etc. One of my colleagues, my fellow pilgrims, is very good on quantum physics. I've been learning from him. So now, something Bhutanese should take cognizance of is their own Buddhist sciences of reality, mind, life, and society. Because Buddhism is very much science. So that idea of a first scientist who knew thoroughly everything, and then there is a progressivism nevertheless in the tradition. You have then Nagarjuna, you have emergence of Mahayana, you have emergence of Vajrayana, because there's a development of ever better ways to enable other human beings to reach the same understanding. On top of Buddha, now Western scientists, Eureka, I found the Higgs boson. But of course you people can't find any Higgs boson. You don't know how to manipulate this kind of machine. That you'd probably blow it up if you tried to run it. And also you don't understand the mathematics and poor regular people. You can only read the New York Times article that I discovered it. So whereas Buddha discovered everything, and then he said, and you all can understand everything. Everyone can become enlightened. But it's how to get them to do. Then that's a vast variety of activities and experience. But imagine the difference. I understand what you can verify personally, not just read a paper and listen to my theory. You can verify it personally. In fact, you shouldn't listen to any theory, even what I say, Buddha said, even what I say might be only valid in a certain context for a certain person, and another person needs another theory. So that's a real difference. That's a marvelous real difference between Buddha scientists and other scientists. So Buddha as scientist, his key discovery is that the unenlightened person has the world upside down, the relative reality is an absolute, we think we are absolute, our rigid self-identity is really us, and that it opposes a world absolutely other, and therefore we're in this situation of struggling against the world, and we lose that struggle, so we suffer. He investigated this and found that it was just an error, it wasn't any bad scheme of anybody, and that the fixed separate self is an illusion, a reality we're free of such an absolute self, and our relative self is free of an absolute self, and therefore he found the solution that way. And realizing that, he enjoyed that, he realized his infinite interconnection with all life, he felt that, and the key there is his feeling of freedom from suffering and bliss, he saw that as within the fabric of every other being, and to find the actual bliss, and in fact, in the medicine tradition, the very health of your cells, of the molecules in your body, is held together by bliss. You're made of bliss, according to Buddha's vision. But he held that back because some people might misunderstand it, some people might misbelieve it, and other people might think, oh, then I can just do any old thing, doesn't matter. And that way they would have gotten just complacent in their ignorance and in their lack of real bliss. So he, you know, he had his different method with different people. And so his wisdom saw that they were made of bliss, but his compassion made him not ignore that they were trapped in suffering, which then made him manifest universal compassion, or actually he connected with the universal compassion of all Buddhas, and Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig, and so forth, and his Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya is still holding us all in a gentle mandala of liberative education. And that's the pathway to, and an infinite pathway of relationality leads you to Buddhahood. It's the only logical thing to do. If you're stuck in life forever, and death is only a change from life to life, and whether that life improves has to do with what you think, what you do, and what you say, you're bound to think, do, and say things that are a little bit better and not a little bit worse, because it goes out with infinite consequence. And okay, now, main scientific discoveries. And there, I used to put a slide in there, I didn't. You know, the three educations in Buddhism, higher educations, the Adishiksha, the Hlakpen Lama Sum. Those three educations are educations. They are not like beliefs. They're education in ethics, education in mind, education in wisdom. The most important of them is the education in wisdom. Education in wisdom means gaining knowledge of reality. So you are going to have to, from Buddha's point of view, it's not a matter of just sitting around believing something. You're going to have to understand reality if you want to be happy. And you can understand reality if you have access to the education that the Buddha left, that he's established, you know. As I like to say when I give talks on the Book of the Dead, nobody gets out of here a dead. You can die, and then you just have to make a new body of some kind, and it will be made by whatever you're made of, what your mind is made of. And you don't stay dead. No way. You don't get out of it all by dying. There's no absolute state of death at all. Just a transition point, like going through a door. And that means quality of life becomes vitally important at a different level of intensity. There's no more reckless, like, be here now, what the heck, who cares? That's not viable when you realize that your consequences of the way you are, even what you think, even if you're not doing anything special, will go on with you forever. And therefore, the only decent way to be forever is to be a Buddha, because they do have more fun. Buddhas do. I know that's a shocking thing to say in a traditional society. But, you know, those Buddhas, those yabyums up there, they're not just like, you know, painting there. They're having more fun than the regular people, because they're in love with everyone in the universe. And they are simple bliss. That's what they are. They don't have to be sitting in yabyum. They can be across the room, and they're still feeling in bliss. But that's what it's saying, those paintings. But anyway, it's in a way, you know, and Chenzin Rinpoche and Gante Tukulpa, and especially Chenzin Rinpoche, who's had so much more exposure to the Western thing, I really look to him for the leadership here. I'm so proud of him trying to translate. For example, when I met with him, and you know, I already, myself, I'm just a poor slob struggling along. I was ordered by my root teacher, an old Mongolian, and the Dalai Lama, to translate the Tenjor when I got my PhD. Thanks a lot. No chance for a golf game or a tennis match. translate the danger as hopeless. And then they, not in one life, two, three lives. Oh, thanks. It's like they're giving me a work program for lifetimes. So then Chenzen Rinpoche comes along. What a wonderful thing. He says, well, he's trying to be polite. He says, we'll do Ganyur. You know, the spirit, the religious text, not the more boring philosophical text. Well, that was sort of division of labor. That was nice. But the motive was so beautiful. My young Bhutanese, he was saying, and I said, and you can add in a lot of Tibetans in either in exile or in China, but especially in exile where the English language is important. My, not only Westerners, but my young Bhutanese will probably not learn to read Chöge. And they will only encounter Buddha's presence in the sutras through English language translation. And therefore, there should be correct and good and accurate one and not distorted one. And so they will read that, you know, they will, Damchu Pema Karpo, oh, that's Chöge. But then they come to the White Lotus Sutra that people read all over Japan and all over, and a lot of people in the West now, and in Australia and all over, and then underground in communist China, they're totally gaga about Buddhism, in fact, because that materialism never satisfies because it's utterly irrational. I like to say, please remember this one statement, the worst form of blind faith is to believe in nothingness. That's the worst blind faith because there, in principle, can never be evidence for the existence of nothingness. So that you will become nothing and don't have to worry about your future life is the worst kind of blind faith, the most irrational. It's better to believe in God running around up there trying to send you down like some sort of a, give you a nice holiday in heaven singing in the choir or something. That's more logical than nothing. And yet that nothing is what the majority of the elite of industrial society do believe in, actually, as their reality that faces them. Okay, thank you, that's enough.
The Bob Thurman Podcast is published by Tibet House US, Menlo Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons, no derivatives, non-commercial license. Please feel free to share on your favorite social media platforms. Tashi Dilek, and thanks for tuning in.